My friend whom I loved so dear, who with me went through every danger. My friend Enkidu, whom I loved so dear, who with me went through every danger. The doom of mortals overtook him. 6 days I wept for him, and 7 nights. I did not surrender his body for burial until a maggot dropped from his nostril. Then I was afraid that I too would die. I grew fearful of death, and so wandered the wild. What became of my friend was too much to bear, so on a far road I wandered the wild. What became of my friend Enkidu was too much to bear, so on a far path I wandered the wild. How can I keep silent? How can I stay quiet? My friend whom I loved has turned to clay. My friend Enkidu whom I loved has turned to clay. Shall I not be like him and also lie down, never to rise again, through all eternity?
Ho-ri-yo, ho, ho.
Hello and welcome once again to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne.
And this time we are looking at the Epic of Gilgamesh.
It's what you would call a foundational text.
It is, and I think that aspect of it, that this is a foundational text, that it is one of the oldest pieces of literature we have, is one of the reasons why people tend to read it.
Yeah, because if you want to tell a story about how literature progresses over time, it's a good starting point. It's not the only one, but it's a good starting point.
Yeah, because not only is it very old, but it's also very compelling. It tells a story about two dudes who are real into each other and the adventures they have and how one of them dies and the other one gets real sad about it and goes on a big epic journey about that. It's got all sorts of fun things, and it's actually really beautifully written in many places.
Yeah, and it's about these two companions, but it's also about the whole world they inhabit. And I think this is one of the things I find most interesting. It's about the city that the story is grounded in, and I find that aspect of it really appealing.
Yeah, it's very hard not to read it as a story about the dawn of civilization, because in the text itself, it makes strong distinctions between the people who live in the city and the people who don't, and how wild and bestial they are. It's also a story that includes a tale of a giant flood in which one guy builds a boat and puts an animal of every type onto it. And so when this text was rediscovered in the 19th century, boy, did that get people's attention.
Oh, yeah. This was a huge focus in the earliest generations of scholarship about the text. And it's also, I think, continues to be really fascinating in ways we might talk about together, because it gives you a kind of a rabbit hole into the past. Because the flood story, when it shows up, is people talking about something that is way back in the past for them. So we sort of reach back into the past to the Gilgamesh time, but then they're in the story reaching way back into a distant past for them.
Exactly. Even though it is a very old text to us, it's several thousands of years old, it nevertheless is a text that's also grappling with the problems of, as they understood it, modernity.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Maybe this is a good time to give a sense of the story.
All right, here's what happens in the Epic of Gilgamesh. Spoilers. I don't know. Is 3,000, 4,000 years enough time to still be worrying about spoilers? I'm not sure. Okay, Gilgamesh, or Gilgamesh, as I guess he's supposed to be called, but I grew up calling him Gilgamesh, so I'm probably going to stick with that. Gilgamesh is a king ruling over the city of Uruk. He is handsome, he is strong, but he is awful to the people of Uruk, getting into fights with the men and doing even worse things with the women. And so the people pray for a solution, and the gods answer by creating Enkidu, or Enkidu, as I grew up calling him. Enkidu is an equal to Gilgamesh in handsomeness and strength, but he has not yet been civilized. And in fact, he lives among the animals, and so Shamhat, who is a sex worker, is sent to attract Enkidu and to civilize him. And so, after several days of sex, Enkidu has lost much of his animal strength, but he has gained reason. And when Enkidu arrives at the city of Uruk and meets Gilgamesh, they start to fight. But they then become fast friends. And so it's time for a road trip. Somehow Gilgamesh gets it into his head that they should go out to the Forest of Cedars and fight the forest guardian Humbaba. Enkidu thinks this is a bad idea, but he's not a coward, and so he agrees to go along with his friend. When they finally arrive and fight, turns out Humbaba knew Enkidu before he got all city-fied, and he begs Enkidu to intercede and ask Gilgamesh to spare him, but Enkidu tells him to finish Humbaba off quickly because the gods will want revenge. So he does. And once they're back in Uruk, the goddess Ishtar takes a fancy to Gilgamesh and asks him to marry her. But he recites a whole litany of her ex-lovers and the terrible things she did to them, and he turns her down. So she goes and borrows her dad's Bull of Heaven and sets it upon the city. It's ferocious, and it kills many people, but Gilgamesh and Enkidu are even more ferocious, and soon the bull is dead. And so the gods get tired of these two, and they decide that somebody needs to be punished. And although Gilgamesh is the instigator, the gods decide that Enkidu should take the fall. And so he is fated to die. And he doesn't get to die in battle, but rather he gets sick, it seems. And over the course of 12 days, he has some vivid dreams, and he curses everything that brought him to the city and to this point. But it's no use. Enkidu dies pitifully. Gilgamesh holds a great funeral for Enkidu, and then he needs to take a walk and have a think, because now he has seen his own mortality in Enkidu's. And so he seeks out the one person who might know how death could be avoided, his ancestor, Utnapishtim, the survivor of the Great Flood. The journey is difficult, but eventually he reaches Utnapishtim, who tries to explain death to Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh wants to know how Utnapishtim gained immortality, and so he tells him the story of the Great Flood. Now, he was told by a god to build a big boat and put an example of every type of creature on it so they might survive while every other living thing perished. And for doing that, the gods granted him immortality. Gilgamesh wants immortality. So Utnapishtim suggests he tries staying awake for a week, which Gilgamesh fails at doing. And so he goes home. And on his way back, he finds this coral under the sea that grants youth to the old. But then a serpent manages to steal it from him, and so Gilgamesh declares that the entire trip has been a waste of time and returns home to Uruk. The end.
I mean, one of the things that's really neat about it is the circularity of the story. Like, a lot of stuff happens, right? But we start at the city and we end in the city, and that kind of symmetry is, I think, really powerful. What's your favorite part?
Oh, I just love Enkidu. He's just adorable.
He is wild.
Did you have a favorite part?
Well, you will not be surprised that my favorite part is the lists and the numbers.
Yeah, those were also fun.
This is something I hope we'll talk about. There's this incredible fascination with number, which I find really, really absorbing in the ways in which it shapes people's experience. And so that might be something we talk about a little bit later.
Well, before we do, do you want to tell us a little bit about where this interesting story and poem came from?
Yeah, let me give a little bit of a sense of it. The text that we have now survives in many copies in different languages, from short fragments to longer texts, not on paper or on parchment, which you might expect, but instead it survives on clay tablets. The language was written down in cuneiform script using a pointed stylus to press wedge-shaped letters into wet clay. And these tablets, even though you might think because they're clay, they're fragile, they're actually extraordinarily durable. And so these tablets have survived over thousands of years, and that's how we have the text now. Cuneiform stopped being used as a means of writing over 2,000 years ago, and the ability to read the cuneiform script written on those tablets was also lost until about 150 years ago. And so that creates a really interesting dynamic around the reception of this text. Even though Gilgamesh only survives in one script format, cuneiform, it survives in multiple languages. And I'm just going to briefly mention what they are without going down that rabbit hole too far. The most important languages for Gilgamesh are Sumerian and Akkadian. And Akkadian is a Semitic language like Hebrew or Arabic, and it gives us Babylonian language and Assyrian language. Anyway, so that Akkadian Semitic language is the main way that we get the text of Gilgamesh. But there's also a version that survives in Sumerian, which is what they call a linguistic isolate. That is, a language is not related to any of the other languages around it. So clearly this is a story that's circulating in multiple languages and multiple communities in this Middle Eastern region, Mesopotamia, what's modern Iraq. And there must have been oral versions of this story circulating for a long time before it was written down, thousands of years ago. It's hard to say exactly how many thousands of years. The version we have now is something over 2,000 years old, and it was redacted at a particular point in the progress of the text. But there's bits and pieces of the text that are probably closer to 4,000 years old. So we know a lot, and yet in some ways we know very little about the exact circumstances of its emergence. A lot of times Gilgamesh gets described as an epic, and maybe we might want to talk about that genre and whether that's a useful category to put it in. And it is useful maybe to think about it as epic in order to put it up against other texts that we've read and talked about. For example, the very first work that we read and talked about on the Spouter Inn, Homer's Iliad, is one that's often juxtaposed with Gilgamesh as a way of thinking about this kind of ancient text. But Gilgamesh is super different from the Iliad in terms of reception. As we discussed way back when we read that book back in like 2019, the Iliad has been responded to, critiqued, adapted, translated, quoted, like it just gets bounced off of for thousands and thousands of years. And we have that very rich layered reception history. But Gilgamesh, because it was only re-encountered about 150 years ago, has what you could say a very recent history of responses to it. In 1872, tablets containing parts of the Gilgamesh story were deciphered, and predictably, the flood story was the thing that really excited that first generation of scholars. But since that time, many more fragments of the poem have been reassembled and integrated into a whole narrative, so that even though we still have a lot of missing parts and rough edges, we can get a sense of Gilgamesh as a whole work, not a complete work, but as one thing. And the one other point I would like to just sort of touch on is that the structure, I think, of the work is really fascinating. It survives, as we mentioned, on cuneiform tablets. And conventionally, the story is broken up not into books, but tablet 1, tablet 2, tablet 3, and so on, up through 11 or 12. You see the publications often give us the sort of 12 tablets worth of Gilgamesh. But in a way, what we have really is 11 tablets plus one tablet. That last one is a kind of appendix or an add-on, a kind of a companion story that goes with what's come before. Those first 11 tablets hang together as a single narrative. And I guess that's all I want to say about the context. I think that there's a lot more you could say, but when you add a lot more historical detail to it, it kind of weighs down the text and makes it almost kind of overdetermined. And to be totally honest, that's something that kept me away from this text for a long, long time. I actually flirted with including it in different courses I taught, and I would look at it and I'd be like, oh, this is just too much and not enough. You know, like I don't have enough connective tissue to put it into a story with other works that make sense. And there's also so much to know to just ground it in its own historical time. So that's made me kind of both attracted to and sort of repelled from it at one and the same time for decades.
Right. It's interesting. Now that you've sort of properly read the book, do you still feel that way?
I still feel like I see it in this like kind of almost binocular way, like these like with two different perspectives. And one is, this is a text in order to grapple with, you really need to have a sense of the historical background. You need to have some sense of the language, at least enough to engage meaningfully with one of the very literal, very scholarly translations that are out there in order to kind of really grapple with what we have there historically and link it up with other ancient narratives. So whether that's Homer's Iliad or biblical books, especially Genesis, but not only Genesis. So that's one way. And then the other way of reading it is because it's this work that's in pieces, in fragments, I almost feel like I could also read it in this very, I don't know what's the right word for it, but like kind of new critical way, or like maybe even surface reading, where you're experiencing the language and interacting with the language at that level and not worrying about historical context, not getting muddied up with that. And I think the most interesting work actually that maybe is happening around this text, or at least the work that I find sort of most sparkly and attractive, is the ways in which translators wrestle with it. There's so many different ways of approaching it. There's a lot of different translations of Gilgamesh out there, and I think we'll talk about that. And they take very different kinds of approaches, and more so perhaps with Gilgamesh than with some other texts, I really think you can make an argument for a lot of different kinds of approaches to translation here. Like you can see it from a number of different vantage points, and that's always true of literary texts, but I think it's true to the 10th degree with Gilgamesh.
I agree with that. Although I feel like there's a lot to be gained by reading translations that are less invested with some of the historicity. So, you know, you basically can divide translations up into people who are trying to represent the tablets in a very scholarly way. The current translation that Penguin Classics put out by Andrew George is like this, where the text is obsessed with telling you, okay, we're missing this part of the tablet, but I'm borrowing it from this other tablet. I'm going to put brackets around each of the words that aren't on the tablet I'm literally doing. And so it's going to be a very busy text that's hard to read, but you'll know exactly where every word I say comes from. You've got that school, and you've also got a school of people who are just like, well, let me try to make a readable text as if we had the whole thing. Let me make some decisions that will inform what the text is. And this is often done by translators or non-scholars in the field, people who may not actually speak any of the ancient languages, such as the previous Penguin Classics version by Nancy Sanders, which is the version that I first encountered when I was an undergrad, which is a very, let's say, liberal translation that is really willing to make severe adaptations into the text or bring in other pieces without fully signaling what's going on in order to create a compelling portrait of what this might look like.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about the historical moment that these translations appear, right? Like, so you're mentioning Nancy Sanders' translation, which I think came out in 1960, which is at a point when Gilgamesh is getting attention already, you know, within obviously, you know, scholarly circles in the field of Middle Eastern civilizations, but it hasn't entered into like the literary canon. Like, it's not showing up in great books courses. It's not going to do that for a couple of decades yet, or at least a decade. And so it's a translation that's maybe making a case for a certain kind of reading or a certain kind of, is deserving a certain amount of attention.
Exactly. And its introduction does spend a lot of time arguing that. And the translation does, by trying to translate it with a tone that's very inflected by the King James Bible. Like, it's really trying to make this seem epic in a certain way. And it succeeds. It's kind of a lovely translation with all of the asterisks that you would put against it.
You know, when we were determining what passage we might read at the beginning for the open, we looked at the different translations. Do you want to just read a couple lines from Sanders just to give an illustration of that King James equality? And I totally agree with you about it.
Sure. So the passage that we read at the opening in Sanders' version goes, "Why should I not wander over the pastures in search of the wind? My friend, my younger brother, he who hunted the wild ass of the wilderness and the panther of the plains, nay, friend, my younger brother, who seized and killed the bull of heaven and overthrew Humbaba in the cedar forest, my friend who is very dear to me and who endured dangers beside me, Enkidu, my brother, whom I loved, the end of mortality has overtaken him. I wept for him 7 days and nights till the worm fastened on him. Because of my brother, I am afraid of death. Because of my brother, I stray through the wilderness and cannot rest."
Yeah, that's a very particular voice. And it's a part, as you said before, it's part of that argument for it being something that should be read, that deserves a place in the literary canon, right?
Exactly.
And there's a new translation that came out not too long ago. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. This is the one that I read, Getting Ready for Today, by Sophus Hella. It's a new translation that I think came out last year, if I'm not mistaken. And there he's taken what Hella describes as a kind of a middle course informed by the sort of very historically grounded literal translation. So he doesn't hold back, for example, from reproducing the many repetitions that we find in the text, which I find really beautiful. But he doesn't muddy up the text with a lot of annotations, and he doesn't give you all those brackets that some of the other translators do. Like, he'll smooth out the language silently, which is, I think, I found it very readable.
Yeah, I ended up mostly reading David Ferry's translation, mm-hmm. which is quite lovely. It's in unrhymed iambic pentameter couplets, but it does collapse some of the repetition that you find in the original. And I found it really useful to have that in one hand and have the George in the other hand, the more scholarly edition. So if I saw something and was like, oh, that's a curious turn of phrase, how is that reflected in a more literal translation? I could do that, but it made a text that I thought was a more easy and compelling read. And it seems like Hella is trying to navigate somewhere between those two positions.
Yeah, I really like the way in which actually he keeps the repetitions, because it provided a kind of a sense of the poignancy that a grieving person has, like in this particular passage. So just a couple lines. He says, I grew scared. He says, afraid of death, I wander the wild. The story of my friend wears me down, so I wander the wild on far off roads. The story of Enkidu wears me down, so I wander the wild on far off roads. Like, it's repetitious, but it's repetitious in the way that grief makes you sort of pick over your grief.
Sure.
And repetitions in other places have a very different kind of function, almost a refrain-like function, which I found really absorbing. And he, I think, brings that out pretty well.
So you can't really go wrong, I think. You can find a translation that fits your style of reading, and I think it's perfectly fine to start with one of the more poetic translations that is less concerned with 100% fidelity to the original. And I think it's marvelous that we have access in the Andrew George translation to a very scholarly edition that is still pretty accessible, but maybe not what I would recommend for anyone for their first read of the poem. We're sort of very lucky right now in terms of how much Gilgamesh we have.
Well, I mean, I think it's lucky, but it's also, it's I think, an expression of the fecundity of the text. Like I said, it's got this shallow reception history, like only got about 150 years of reception, right? But it's brought out a lot of creativity on the part of the translators, which is what we've been discussing, but also I think in other sort of cultural environments as well, right? So it's very generative.
Well, so you raised some questions when you introduced this, and one of those questions was about the nature of epic. Do you find this to be a useful text to think of as an epic? And, you know, how does it compare with the Iliad, which I suppose is the most epic, or the most sort of quintessential epic?
Yeah. Well, I guess like putting like my teacher hat on, right? I could imagine that kind of label being useful as a way of thinking about what other texts we could compare it to readily. And the Iliad is a really good example. Epic generally means it's going to be poetry. It's going to be long. It's going to have a sustained narrative. It's going to have a hero, maybe more than one hero. There's going to be fighting. There's probably going to maybe be some gods involved. You know, there's, it's a martial action on a large scale, right? And like every genre, this is just a label. Like it's like labeling, you know, your drawer, sock drawer, you know, as opposed to underwear drawer. You know, I mean, it's just a way to organize text. And writers sometimes very self-consciously will be using that, right, at certain points in literary history. But it doesn't ultimately kind of mean anything whether you did label as an epic or not an epic, right? It's a tool. It's kind of instrumental. So if it helps you to think about its relationship to other ancient texts, and the Iliad is a good one, that can be useful. But it's also, you know, doing things that in some ways really resemble I don't know if creation literature is the right way to describe it. Like, I'm thinking of Genesis in particular, not just because of the flood story, but this quality of repetition, this preoccupation with number that I mentioned earlier, which has a certain flavor in Gilgamesh, but you see show up also in the last chapters of Genesis when they're describing the making of the Ark of the Covenant and stuff like that, and the temple grounds. There's a real preoccupation with measurement, you know? So there's qualities that are not necessarily particularly epic, but you can use to relate Gilgamesh to other ancient literature. So like, that's a really waffly answer. I'm like, yeah, epic can be useful, but it is not an answer, I don't think.
Well, sure. I mean, what does epic mean, I suppose, is the crux of the problem. But I do find that it is useful in terms of setting expectations when you go in to read it, at least for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. You know, we talked a lot in our episode on the Iliad, oh, so many years ago, about the unexpectedly personal nature of this giant story of, you know, legendary warrior men and the gods that intervene in their fight and so forth.
There was a great intimacy.
Yes. And we find that here too, right? This is a story of larger than life figures, of figures who, if they had some historical reality as people, have been told and retold and made more and more grand and stand in for forces beyond what any individual person can, right? They've become legendary. They are also, you know, Gilgamesh is descended from a god, is two-thirds god, he's described as, which is marvelous.
Yeah.
And the gods intervene in the story. And yet you have all of these incredibly tender and personal moments between characters as well. You know, as Enkidu is sick and feverish and having a series of dreams, and Gilgamesh is attending to him. You have all the specificities of how they interact in this incredibly intimate scale. And it's that marriage of the two that I think is one of the most compelling things about the story, about the poem.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get this weird contrast between moments where they're being big and epic and, you know, warrior men, like when they confront the bull of heaven. So Enkidu talks to Gilgamesh. This is near the end of Tablet 6. He says, "I'll sneak up behind the bull and grab the tuft of its tail. With my foot on its hock, I'll hold it. Then you, like a butcher, brave and deft, thrust in your sword between neck, horns, and spine." Enkidu sneaked up behind the bull and grabbed the tuft of its tail. And then Gilgamesh, like a butcher, thrust in his sword, right? So they're doing all this kind of stuff. But this brings them together. That passage closes saying that after they killed the bull of heaven, they cut out its heart and gave it to the sun god. They stepped back and bowed before Shamash. Then the two of them sat down together. And that the two of them sat down together is a great moment, right? Because it's capturing that intimacy that emerges from this warrior relationship that they have. They're almost like two halves of a whole in their most intimate. And therefore, you also got these very, very tender moments like what you were describing. So at a certain point in tablet four, Enkidu prepares the place for Gilgamesh to have his prophetic dreams. Enkidu built him a house for the dream god with a windbreak against the storm. He had Gilgamesh lie in a circle of sacred flower while Enkidu slept like a snare in the doorway. And then there's just cycle after cycle of dream. And then this description of the two of them, Enkidu building the house, Gilgamesh lying in the circle of sacred flower, Enkidu sleeping in the doorway like a snare or a trap. And it's, I don't know if that's intimate in a conventional way, but for some reason it struck me as incredibly intimate. Gilgamesh is in this vulnerable kind of position, you know, waiting for a revelation, waiting for a dream that's going to guide him. He's in this kind of sacred space they've made out of flower in a circle form. And Enkidu makes the house and sleeps in the doorway, like a protective animal might do for you, like a dog might guard your door, but also like a beloved person would do protecting another, whether it was a parent and a child or a sibling and a sibling or a lover and a beloved. I mean, that house image strikes me as intimate in a very particular kind of way, a very powerful kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And is part of a whole series of descriptions of both Gilgamesh and Enkidu that really, you know, suggests that it's at times, it's real easy to ship them.
Maybe the text invites this, right? Like, this is the thing. Like, I think we'll want to talk a little bit about their individual characters, but just continuing with their pairing, their relationship. We're invited to understand it in a number of different ways. It's clearly an incredibly intimate relationship. They're a couple. There's no question about that. And the question is, how do we understand the couple, right? And I don't think that, how can I put it? I don't think there's one simple answer to that. It's tempting to compare them to Achilles and Patroclus in the Iliad, but I think they're quite different from that in the sort of junior-senior relationship of Achilles and Patroclus is very kind of, it's a bit overdetermined in the Iliad. Like, you really understand how they're situated in that relationship. Whereas Gilgamesh and Enkidu, it seems a little bit more complex. At certain moments, it's explicitly described as a brother relationship. So at a certain point at the end of Tablet 3, Ninsun, who's Gilgamesh's divine mother, she adopts Enkidu as her own son. She says, "I hereby take Enkidu as my beloved son. Let Gilgamesh treat him with brotherly love." So in that moment, they become members of the same family, right? They're brothers. But there's other moments as well that bring them together as two warriors, like we saw when they kill the Bull of Heaven together. And also these intimate moments where they're in that household, the house of dreams, waiting for the prophetic dream. And then there's a moment when Enkidu describes his own body in a way that makes it clear that he and Gilgamesh have an intimate familiarity with one another's bodies. Right. So I'm kind of resisting using contemporary language to describe the nature of that relationship, right? Other than saying it's intimate, it's bodily in a number of different kinds of ways. It's fascinating, I think. What do you make of it?
Well, I also think it's interesting because Enkidu is literally made for Gilgamesh to be a companion and to be an equal. And they are both at various times described as womanly in interesting ways. In fact, the first thing we hear about Enkidu is that he's made and he has long tresses, long hair, like those of a woman. And similarly, when Enkidu dies, Gilgamesh refers to himself as, you know, he's going to weep for Enkidu, my friend, like a hired mourner woman, I shall bitterly wail. They're very comfortable with entering into those spaces, so to speak, and using that language. And when Enkidu has not yet met Gilgamesh, but he's getting prepared for meeting him, Gilgamesh has a series of dreams of a meteor and of an axe. And Ninsun explains these to him as saying, well, someone's coming. And like a wife, you'll love him, caress him, and embrace him. And, you know, it's also interesting, I find that when they actually do meet, it is because Gilgamesh is on his way to interrupt a wedding to have his way with the bride. And Enkidu doesn't care for this and stops him. And like that one desire that was going towards the bride has been transferred onto Enkidu, right? Mm-hmm. This is a replacement mm-hmm. for that kind of improper affection.
Enkidu is able to absorb all of this superabundance that's coming from Gilgamesh, right? Gilgamesh is not monstrous exactly, but he's like, he's too much, right? He's two thirds God and one third man, which I just absolutely love. Like, just parenthetically, like Achilles, you know, with regard to his semi divinity, it's like, you know, mom's a goddess, dad's immortal kind of thing, right? That's what we're accustomed to seeing from those kinds of texts. Here, it's like, I love the fact that the proportion is managed in this, you know, very different kind of way. Sounds very cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Enkidu is able to absorb this. Like, he can, it's like grounding electricity or something like that. Like, he is capable of absorbing all of that, what is coming from Gilgamesh. And I think it's really neat that it's absolutely, there are these languages chosen to invoke the feminine as part of what's happening there. But it's not just the feminine. In the description of Enkidu's creation, he's said to be woven for war. All of his body was covered with fur. His hair was as long as a woman's, and his locks curled thick like ears of corn. He knew no people and no country. Naked like an animal, with the gazelles he grazed on grass, with the herd he rushed to drink, with the beasts he quenched his thirst. One day by the waterhole, he locked eyes with a hunter, a woodsman. One day, and a second, and a third, Enkidu and the hunter locked eyes by the waterhole. The hunter looked at him and froze with fear, then headed home with his catch. So it's like, he's not an animal, but he's kind of animal proximate.
Oh, yeah.
And he's not a woman, but he's kind of, you know, he's got the hair of a woman, this long hair. And he's his hair is also to be curled like ears of corn are curled, right? And so he's, earlier you said that's part of that sort of nature-culture divide that is happening here. Like, there's the life of the city and there's the remote life that we see in the cedar forest, for example. But Enkidu is like, he's, I don't know how to put it, he's like liminal, or he's like, he's on the edges of things. And that's what gives him this potentiality to absorb what Gilgamesh has.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's he's a fascinating character that way. I also enjoy how when they're fighting with Humbaba sort of tries to use this against him, spins it in a somewhat different way, and says to him, "Come, Enkidu, you spawn of a fish who knew no father, hatchling of terrapin and turtle who sucked no mother's milk."
Them's fighting words.
Yeah, but it's also like, how many different angles of attack is that all about the sort of animal nature of where Enkidu comes from, right? How he doesn't quite fit in with this new civilized clothes he's wearing, so to speak.
And there's another dimension to the description of Enkidu too, which I find absolutely fascinating. He's repeatedly likened to a meteorite.
Yes.
Over and over again. He's said to be, at one point, as mighty as a meteorite fallen from the sky. And that phrase recurs from different people at different moments in that whole section. And so, you know, so he's not, how can I put it? He's coming from some peripheral place, whether it's the wild areas of the land, or whether it's from the sky, wherever it is he comes from, it's not here.
He's adorable.
He is adorable. I've
always, even when I, you know, first read it, I always thought Enkidu is just great. What can I say? The other thing I wanted to say about something that you said a little bit earlier was you quoted when Gilgamesh's mom, Ninsun, adopts Enkidu and refers to him as, you know, my beloved son, let Gilgamesh treat him with brotherly love. And while you're right that is sort of like, okay, the two of you are now like brothers, like adopted brothers, that's also language that we use now, at least,
yes,
when people get married and you
that's
welcome
right.
in the new spouse into the family.
Exactly.
So it's not like I don't know, but it is a possibility space.
No, that's what I meant by saying it's not exclusive.
Yeah.
Totally agree with you. And that's why that there's this language of sacrality that the goddess uses in that passage, which I think is really suggestive. She says, "Enkidu, you were not born from my womb, but now your family will be Gilgamesh's temple." And again, that's very, I don't know if it's marital language specifically, but it has that kind of quality to it. Like they're going to have one house, as it were, right? And therefore that dream house that I mentioned a little earlier is a beautiful expression of this intimacy that they've entered into with one another.
Yeah. In the George translation, that's also really interesting because the line is, "Oh, mighty Enkidu, you are not sprung from my womb, but henceforth your brood will belong with the votaries of Gilgamesh, the priestesses, the Hierodules, and the women of the temple."
Uh-huh. So that is a kind of linkage, like a familial linkage, like they've become one family, right? And that is very marital.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally.
And so when sadly Enkidu has to pass and die, Gilgamesh takes it real hard. What did you think of that whole post-death sequence?
Well, there's a lot to it, I have to say. One thing I was really struck by is when immediately with the death of Enkidu, you know, when we're at the beginning of Tablet 8, Gilgamesh begins his weeping. You know, it's dawn, he begins his weeping. And all that animal language that we were talking about earlier in the creation of Enkidu comes back again. So Gilgamesh says, Enkidu, born to a gazelle and an onager, your parents, and you were brought up by donkeys and led to pasture by the beasts. May boxwood, cypress, and cedar weep for you, the trees we crept through in our wrath. May the bear, hyena, leopard, cheetah, deer, jackal, lion, oryx, stag, ibex, beast, and herd of the wild weep for you. May the holy river Ule weep for you. May the sacred Euphrates weep for you. And he goes on. So it's really interesting how that natural environment, needless to say, that great animal catalog, you know, that comes back again as the grief pours out.
Yeah.
And so that initial response I thought was really interesting. It's kind of almost a creation moment again, but it's in the mode of grief.
Yeah. The list of people and creatures, I guess, who he calls upon to mourn for Enkidu starts with these natural things, these trees, and then the animals, and then, you know, the rivers, and then we get into the people of the city who should also mourn. So this list also shows this passage from nature into civilization.
That's right.
Which is a nice little formal move.
Yeah. And then he moves into this kind of, I don't know what to call it, embodied mourning that involves sacrifice as well. So he lays out the body. He says, I will lay you on a mighty bed. I will lay you on a bed of glory. You will sit at ease by my left hand while the lords of the underworld kiss your feet. And then he goes to the treasury and breaks the seal, surveys the jewelry, obsidian, carnelian, lapis lazuli, alabaster. And then there's a lovely description. It's fragmentary, but it's very beautiful of all the things he gave his friend. He gave his friend gold, and then there's lost parts of the tablet, right? So we just see the repeated refrain, he gave his friend gold. And then there's all these things that must be listed. The parts that where we have the tablet again, pounds of ivory, he gave his friend something with a golden handle, and it goes on. So there's this incredible abundance of gold and ivory and carnelian and so on, and then slaughtered animals that are all heaped up. And these are in memory of Enkidu, but they're gifts to the underworld lords. So there's a whole list then of the gods of the underworld that are being propitiated. So there's a very strong sense of kind of ritual, all the things that must be done, like the funeral things, like what we see with Hector's funeral feast in the last book of the Iliad, right? Very similar kind of move. But then Gilgamesh goes out into the world in this kind of wandering, which is impelled by his grief.
Yes. Although I do want to add one more thing just about the way that gender is playing out with these characters. After he's prepared all these things, he covered, like a bride, the face of his friend. Like an eagle, he circled around him. Like a lioness deprived of her cubs, he paced to and fro, this way and that. It's just like, yep, that's I don't know. That's happening.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's what I mean by emphasizing like intimacy and the passionate nature of their relationship. Like there's They're a pair, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, yes, he goes out into the world looking for his ancestor to learn the secret of eternal life.
Yeah, and the teaser for that is kind of neat. You know, when we're at the end of Tablet 8, this is when all the ritual things have been done that we were just describing. Gilgamesh gets an idea. It's the way that Hellas translation puts it. It says, when Gilgamesh heard this, the idea of the river found form in his heart. And the idea of the river, you might be like, well, what is that? It's a thread almost that's going to lead him on this journey, seeking out the river and ultimately guides who could lead him to his ancestor, who's going to be able to give him the answers he wants about immortality. And that's really interesting because you might be like, well, he's really bummed that his beloved is dead. How is immortality going to help him out? Like, how is an eternity without your beloved good in that, you know, in that moment, right? But where that comes from, I think, is the nature of his response to Enkidu's death, which is sorrow for his friend, but also an awareness that this also is going to be his fate. In other words, the sorrow he feels at the loss of his beloved companion is both for Enkidu himself, but it's also this anxiety, I think, about what's going to happen to him. And that's why he goes seeking the river.
Yeah, as somebody who had no equal, who had no one who could compare with him, he had never, I think, thought of himself as mortal.
Yeah. Well, like, remember the passage we opened this conversation with? He says, my friend Enkidu, whom I loved, has turned to clay. Am I not like him? I too will lie down and never get up.
Right. And so he now recognizes this in the first person that he's felt some sort of comparability with, right? Some sort of measurability with, who has now died. And so he realizes his own mortality. And yet he is still imbued with the divine from his godly parent. And he also asserts his heritage of an ancestor who was turned into a god, right? Like, this is something that he has access to that most people don't. And he's going to attempt to see if he can take full advantage of this and escape the fate that his friend had for him, which I find quite interesting. He doesn't get to do.
It's so great because, like, you really feel like the story is going in this one direction. Like, he finds, you know, the different people, the innskeeper, the riverman, you know, that lead him to his ancestor. He gets to his ancestor. He gets the whole flood story, all this backstory, this ancient knowledge, and finally this secret that his ancestor imparts to him about how you can achieve the immortality you're looking for, right? So Gilgamesh finds this plant, maybe it gets translated sometimes as coral. It's clear he has to burrow under water and earth, right? So sand, maybe, to get this treasure, right? Then he has this plant, but then you think he's got what he's been looking for. He's right on the threshold of this immortality he seeks. And then what happens? That snake, you know, turns up and steals your beautiful plant, and you're screwed.
It happens so fast, too. It's just a few lines later. It's just, he gets it. He's all excited about his big plans. And then, nope, boom. It's just immediately taken from him.
I know. What do you make of that ending?
I loved it. It's such a damp squib of an ending. It's such a nothing ending. It's like, you don't get a big fight with a snake or anything. You don't, there's nothing like that. It's just, and then there was a snake and it smelled it and it took it and he was sad and he went home.
Here's Hela. So they stopped to eat. They pitched camp. Gilgamesh found a pool with cool water. He went down to swim in the pool. A snake smelled the scent of the plant. It slid up in silence. It snatched it away and shed its skin as it slithered back. Then Gilgamesh sat down crying, tears streaming down his cheeks, like, dude, what happened? Right? It's like you said, it's like, boom, and quiet and sneaky. It's not a battle. It's nothing like that.
And so the poem ends with this dejected impossibility of immortality. It has no answers for you. It's just, yeah, no, people are, you're going to die. That's what the gods have decreed.
Yeah, it does. That's right. But it also has this like last turn, which I find also totally enchanting. You know, they finish up with this camp, they're heading back, they make it back to Uruk, to the city. And the last couple of lines of the poem, Gilgamesh says, climb the wall of Uruk, Ur-Shanabi, walk its length, survey the foundation, study the brickwork. There, is it not made of oven-baked bricks? Look, 2,000 acres for the city, 2,000 acres for the orchards, 2,000 acres for the pits of clay, and 1,000 acres for the temple of Ishtar. 7,000 acres is the size of Uruk. And that's the end, right? With like this description of the city, which is highly numerical, highly orderly, and it's asking you to see this, right? I mean, that look, the verb there, that's something that Hela puts in, and he talks about it in the introduction, because he also is really struck by this vision of the city, which punctuates the end of the epic, like this description of the city, the acreage of the city that comes at the end and also shows up right at the beginning. And so when he puts in that look, it's a way of kind of making you, I don't know, be brought up short by the sight of the city walls almost, and by the sight of the city, which I find really neat. I find that really compelling.
Yeah. And the city, which is going to outlast Gilgamesh and
everybody.
Everyone who reads this. Well, turns out no, but but from their perspective, absolutely.
Well, I guess what I mean is that, like, in a fragmentary way, in a broken kind of way, that does survive, right? Like, we have like sort of archaeological knowledge of these cities, and in particular the oven-baked bricks that get mentioned as they're the bricks that make up the city, right? Bricks made of clay that are baked. But also the tablets that the poem comes to us on are also oven-baked, like bricks or slabs of clay, right? So there's this kind of, I don't know, the city and the poem are both made up, as it were, of bricks of clay, which is kind of cool. And we get, I think, invited to think about that relationship of the baked pieces of clay that make up the city and the baked clay pieces that make up the work. In the opening of the poem, when right after we get that description of the city, 2,000 acres for the city, 2,000 acres for the orchards, 2,000 acres for the pits of clay, 1,000 acres for the temple of Ishtar. Immediately after that, we get this. Now look for the cedarwood box. Undo its locks of bronze. Open the door to its secrets. Take up the tablet of lapis lazuli and read aloud. Read all of that Gilgamesh went through. Read of all his suffering. So it's a lapis lazuli, like a very precious blue stone tablet instead of the real clay tablets we would have. But it's being juxtaposed with the city itself, which I think that's very cool.
Yeah, no, both the city and the poetry will outlast.
Yeah, in pieces maybe, right?
Yeah, well, they didn't know that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But certainly that's going to be on our mind when we read this 3,000 plus year old piece now.
Yeah, maybe them too, though, right? Because as you said, in a way, Gilgamesh is the story of people who are struggling with their own modernism, like thousands of years ago, right? Because that reaching back to the distant past when Gilgamesh encounters his ancestor and hears the story about the flood and all this stuff that happened way back when, like they're aware of the passage of time on that big scale, I think as much as we are.
Well, I hope you're glad that you finally read Gilgamesh.
I am. It took me a while to get to it. And then also even now getting ready, it took me a while. I kept bumping up against, I don't know enough of the background. But at a certain point, I just got to like, wow, I'm really enjoying this. And like I said, the number stuff, the orderliness, the repetitions, I found those really affective. Like I found those really moving in all kinds of ways.
It is a real trick, especially when you're making a podcast like this, right? Where, you know, we're talking about the books that we're reading and we're talking about our reactions to them, but we're also doing a bit of presenting them in their context and trying not to get that wrong. And so wanting to have mastery over Gilgamesh is a lot to ask of somebody.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's a fool's errand.
right. Exactly. And so you're never going to quite reach up to it. I mean, even this Penguin Classics Andrew George translation comes with a bunch of other related texts, which I, you know, poked my nose into a little bit, but I wasn't going to try to read and prepare them for all of this. There's more out there to explore. They look very promising. There's a whole family of Gilgamesh and Enkidu stories, including the story that's on the 12th tablet, in which Enkidu goes into the underworld to pick up something for Gilgamesh and gets stuck there. And we get a description of what the underworld is like, which is always a fun thing.
Which I loved. Like, I know we don't have time to talk about it in detail, but I love thinking about that against other stories of the underworld that I was familiar with from especially Greek and Roman literature, or I should say Latin and Greek literature. So that was really cool to find that there. And then I'm sure you'd find it in a lot of other literatures as well, maybe in, for example, Egyptian literature.
Absolutely. But I think there's a lot to enjoy just reading it as a casual, as they say. I think there's a lot that's compelling about it, even if you don't approach it trying to gain mastery over it. So I'm glad you were able to get through it. I think the other interesting thing that we've talked about this before is going back to texts and sort of how you read it changing over time. Because as I said, this is a text I read when I was young as an undergrad in one translation and didn't pick up again until a few years ago when I was going to be talking about it for another podcast and picked up the new George translation because I knew that more bits of the tablets had been found and was shocked to discover how radically different it was from the Nancy Sanders version. And I sort of panicked and just reread the Nancy Sanders version and went with that. I'm glad that I spent a little time trying to, you know, piece together various translations for this episode. But also, it's interesting because, of course, the different parts of the poem hit me differently now. I remember finding all of the post-death of Enkidu stuff really boring the first time through. And I found it a lot more interesting on this time through, I don't know, maybe my thoughts on nature of mortality have changed as I've gotten a bit older.
Yeah, well, no, it makes sense. We're different people in a way when we read at different times, right? And so it makes sense we have that kind of experience.
Exactly. But I also carried with it that familiarity with the text where we've talked about if you go back to a book you know a lot, you might skip over certain passages and focus on the passages that you like. And so I found myself sort of rushing past certain parts of the text and really digging deep into other parts of the text that I enjoyed. So like the journey from Uruk to see Utnapishtim, it's a really long and involved sequence involving him going through monsters and meeting guides and repeating the same text over and over again. And I sort of skimmed through it really quickly when I was reading it this time, and then sort of stopped and went back and read it again. Because I sort of realized, wait, that was actually much stranger and more interesting than I recognized. What's happening there? So I don't know, the nature of becoming familiar and then becoming unfamiliar with the text again and again as you read it, especially if you read it in multiple translations, I felt it really playing out even more than usual when I was rereading Gilgamesh.
No, I think that is an incredibly important point, right? Like, I think sometimes people feel about books we read, and especially if you're reading like quote-unquote great books, like books that have, I don't know, a lot of aura attached to them one way or the other. It's like you read it and now you've read it and that's it. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like a transactional kind of experience.
Right.
But this other way of reading where it can be you dip in, you dip out, maybe you read the whole thing, maybe you read some parts, you read it at this point when you were a teenager, you read it another time, or at least part of it when you were at another stage of life. Like, that brings out for you both how you change and therefore the book looks different, but also how the book itself has all these different faces, and that's just a really neat thing to encounter.
Well, listeners, you may have noticed, if you were paying very close attention, that we did not open this by talking about what cluster we're reading Gilgamesh within. Although, Suzanne and I have talked for a long time about doing a cluster on sad boys in literature, and Gilgamesh absolutely would have counted for that cluster.
100%.
But we're doing something a little bit different in 2023. Over the 10 months between February and November, we're going to be looking at works from different periods in literature. We've looked at a lot of topics. We've had a good sampling of literature that's very old and very new. And we've, you know, put 60-odd episodes of that under our belts. And we thought now we would do a little walk through literary history, just idly gleaning here and there. But that's why we started with this very, very old piece of literature.
Yeah, I really like this approach because it's not like these are the 10 books one should read, but rather like when you think about stones in a stream, you know, you step on one and then you step on the one that's sort of, you know, a little ways away, but not too far, right? You know, it's like a path that kind of emerges organically. And so I think that with these books that we're going to read over the next months, we'll have that kind of, you know, surprising, organic kind of path across the river.
Yeah, that I think is the idea, that we're just going to see what we see. We're not trying to programmatically pick 10 related books or anything, which is why the next book that we're going to be reading is from a little bit later than Gilgamesh. There's sort of a big gap, I suppose, but we're going to be returning to ancient Greece by looking at Sophocles' play Antigone.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this because I read it long ago. Like, I was literally a teenager. I read this, not in the translation that we'll be reading next time, which I think will be Ann Carson's translation. It was another, like, probably Penguin Classics kind of one. But it will be really fun to have that experience of going back in time, but also being in a very much a present moment.
Yes, we'll be reading specifically the Ann Carson version, though, you know, maybe we'll have endless books of different translations next to us by the end of it. Who knows? But I have not read this in a good long while, and I am looking forward to revisiting it. So we've picked out most of the books that we're going to be looking at this year, at least in pencil, and we will put a link to those. But some of you might want to not be spoiled. Might want to take it one at a time. I don't know. It seems like fun to me. So we're not going to tell you on the podcast every book that we're going to be doing this year. But if you want to know and you want to send us an email arguing that we should look at something else, good luck. But we'll have that available in the show notes. But until then, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or we're on Twitter still, @TheSpouter. We'd love to hear from you. Show notes with links for things that we've mentioned in this episode will be at megaphonic.fm/spouter/65, and The Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So until next time.
Until next time. See you again at The Spouter Inn.